sports, entertainment, and Maine's best guest list. On The Pulse, AM 620 WZON, WZONThePulse.com, and the WZON app. This is Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Hey, good Sunday morning. Welcome in. It's the best of Downtown on your 29th day of October. Rich Kimball and Carrie Haskell here with you. Our look back at some of our favorite conversations from the past week, brought to you this morning and every afternoon by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. And by Quirk Auto Group, QuirkAuto.com. It's your car. Find it at Quirk. Our guests are heard on the G&M Family Market phone line. G&M on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Open every day from 6 a.m. until 9 p.m. On the show this morning, we talk with author W. Bruce Cameron about his newest novel, A Dog's Way Home. Colin Fleming talks a little music with us, a couple of talented British artists, The Who, that he calls the ultimate singles band, and the lesser-known but awfully talented Nick Drake. That's later on in the program, but we get things rolling by talking football. Patriots take on the San Diego / Los Angeles Chargers today. And we broke it all down on Friday's program as we caught up with our friend Andy Hart of Patriots Football Weekly. Before we get to the football talk, I did want to mention, I hope it's not a sore subject. You were, of course, as you remember, the runner-up in our Downtown Madness competition last year, the second most popular guest we had from the hundreds that were with us last year, losing to Bryan Cranston. Cranston's back on the show next Thursday to talk about his new movie, if you want to call in and heckle.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I just have to bow down to him. As you know, as Ricky Bobby said in Talladega Nights, second place is first loser. So I'm a loser like all the rest.
Yeah, but you can hold it over all those other Boston guys that you crush them.
That's right. Let's remember the good.
Because you're going to see them. You're not going to see Cranston.
That's right. Yeah, I don't really run in the same circle.
Only on the radio, right?
That's right. Yep. I guess we're together in at least one place.
There you go. Well, let's talk about the Patriots and what's going on. The injury done for the season. Dante Hightower getting a little thin there at linebacker.
Yeah, no question. And it's a blow not just on the field, where we've seen they have issues, they have depth issues, but I'm just as concerned as what's going to take place in terms of leadership. I think he's a guy that. On this team, he's the guy that's not afraid to sort of yell at people or bring it all together. And, you still have leaders. I'm not going to say that Devin McCourty or Daron Harmon or those guys on defense aren't leaders, but they lead in a different way. They lead by example. And I think Hightower's a guy that, could do the Vince Wilfork thing, sort of the Willie McGinnis thing, and kick somebody in the butt if they needed kicking in the butt. And then in terms of on-field, obviously we've seen it. I mean, the last two Super Bowls, that guy made game-changing plays. You probably don't have two Super Bowl rings without him, and that clutch factor and that ability to be on the field when he was needed most late in the year, even though he dealt with previous injuries. So, yeah, they're going to have to find a way in that front. I mean, has some other injuries. Malcolm Brown is going to miss this week's game with an ankle injury. They're obviously already playing with guys like Cassius Marsh and David Harris in sort of increased roles, so they need to prove they can pull it all together. It's going to be a challenge for not just the players, but I would say Matt Patricia and Bill Belichick.
And you wrote that a guy like Alan Branch may end up being the key to the Patriot run defense this week.
Yeah, no question. You don't have a lot of guys that you can lean on in there. And it's funny because he's a guy that, just a couple weeks ago was a healthy scratch and people were wondering what was his role. Was he in the doghouse? He's come back and he's played well since then. And I think you're going to need him to do that because the San Diego, that's the first time, the L.A. Chargers, they want to run the football with Melvin Gordon. That's part of their plan, and he hasn't run great. He's at like 3.4 yards per carry, but they want to run the football. And then, stay in third and short and let Phillip Rivers throw to Hunter Henry or Gates or Keenan Allen on third down. So they're going to come in and try to establish the run, and with Hightower out, and a Landon Roberts banged up, and Malcolm Brown out. I think you need the veteran Alan Branch to come up big for you this week.
Does the call go out to Rob Ninkovich?
That's interesting. He's poo-pooed it, but he's also admitted that, he sort of talked about it enough to know that it's kind of enticing to him, and I can't imagine how it wouldn't be. Everybody wants to be needed, and he probably, early in retirement, we hear people in any aspect of life, never mind sports or football, they admit that they miss it a little bit or have that itch. I don't think he's going to come back, and I'm not sure what he'd be able to offer on the field. I'd love to see him come back as a leader. You know, what I started with, I think the leadership loss is huge, and I think Rob Ninkovich would help fill that void. But on the field, I think he, you know, was showing his age last year, the last couple of years. His production had diminished. Would he be equivalent to some of these guys? Maybe just based on experience, you know, getting by on experience as much as anything. But he admitted when he retired that, you know, he couldn't sort of lie to his body anymore. And I just, you know, a guy can stay in shape and go to the gym a lot. That doesn't mean he's ready to play in an NFL game. So I have my doubts as to whether he's a legitimate option at this point. But, you know, if they get desperate enough, maybe he will be.
Secondary looked pretty good last week. But when I hear people say, well, the secondary's better without Gilmore back there, that seems like a stretch to me.
It does. And, you know, you had Jonathan Jones, a second-year undrafted player, and Johnson Batamosi, a sixth-year, basically special teamer, former undrafted guy out there. And they were getting the job done. And, you know, we saw the communication was better, whatever you want to call it. There weren't runaway receivers, guys uncovered running across the field. But I still find it hard to believe that you're better off without two of your top three corners, because Eric Rowe's been out too. So to just say that the problem was two of your more talented players and you're better off with lesser talents out there, I don't necessarily think that's the case. But that's a challenge that those guys face, is sort of getting reacclimated with this defense. And I think you'll get Gilmore back this week. And if we start to see guys running uncovered or Gilmore running in the wrong direction, you're right. The fan base is going to start to really wonder what the heck is going on, because I've seen those tweets and heard those emails and everything already. So I do. I think you're better with a talented player. I think you're always better with more talented players. But Gilmore needs to prove that he can fit in with this secondary and not look like it did against Carolina when it was hellacious.
Andy Hart of Patriots Football Weekly with us here on Downtown. Offensively, Patriots have got to be concerned with that tough rush from L.A. You got guys like Joey Bosa, Chris McCain up there. That's going to put some pressure. And obviously, the Patriots want to avoid getting in those predictable third and long situations.
Yeah, no question. That was the talking point all week, from Bill Belichick to Tom Brady, Rob Gronkowski. Pretty much everybody that talked had a press conference. Certainly offensive players talked about Bosa, Melvin Ingram. I think Belichick called it a special group of pass rushers, because, you know, a lot of teams have one great pass rusher, a guy with, you know, 8, 9, 10 sacks. Not too many teams have two of them, and that's what they have. You know, I think they have 16 sacks between them. The San Diego pass rush as a group, I think, is fourth in the NFL in sacks per pass play. So this is a pretty legit front, and you see some of the highlights. From a week ago against Denver, there was one hellacious hit that Ingram put on Trevor Siemian that he got a penalty, actually, and I think the penalty was basically he hit the guy too hard. You're not supposed to hit quarterbacks hard anymore, but that's the scary part of this Chargers team, is we've seen the Patriots have some issues in pass protection. It's been better in recent weeks, but you still had a runaway rusher last week with the strip sack on Tom Brady, forced the fumble. You can't keep having those, and, you know, Bosa and Ingram do that to a lot of teams. So, and then the other aspect is Marcus Cannon pops up on the injury report late in the week with an ankle injury again. So, you know, we already wonder how good those tackles have been and are, how capable they are against these elite rushers. And then, you know, one of them might be dealing with a little something on the right side there. So it's a major challenge for Nate Solder and Marcus Cannon and the rest of that front. But I also think, you know, Brady said, I got to get rid of the ball fast this week. And you might need the backs to stay in. You might need Rob Gronkowski to help out. Because we know if you're going to beat the Patriots, more often than not, you put pressure on Tom Brady and hit Tom Brady. And the more that happens, not only the worse news it is for the game at hand, this individual game, but, you know, that takes a toll as the season wears on. So, yeah, priority number one for the offense is to block Bosa and Ingram and the rest of those rushers.
162 rushing yards last week, and that was certainly crucial for them. Is that going to be part of the game plan again, to get out there and utilize the ground game more?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it is. You know, talking to Nate Solder recently, he emphasized how nice it is, A, to run the ball, that they like to run the ball, but B, it does take a little bit of the wind out of the sails of those pass rushers when you run right at them. And I would include the screen game in that. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, they haven't been a huge running back screen team lately. I wouldn't be surprised to see some screens, try to take advantage, see if you can get Bosa and Ingram to get upfield, and then, you know, you just drop it right over the top of them for those what can be frustrating plays for a defensive front. But you're right, a season high in rushing yards. I thought they really, that was part of how they controlled the game. They built a lead there in the second quarter against the Falcons and then sort of just ran the game out, controlled it in the second half. Deion Lewis has really come on of late. I think it's three or four straight weeks he's seen an increase in yards and carries, and I think has really made a bid to kind of get back to that role he had early in 2015 before he tore the ACL as the primary back, the lead back. And, you know, he can be out there for extended periods as both a runner and a pass catcher, and, you know, that brought a unique dimension to that offense as opposed to, you know, Mike Gillisley's out there on early downs, or LeGarrette Blount last year was out there on early downs, and then you go to later downs and it's Deion Lewis or James White. If you can keep one back on the field more often and run the ball out of it successfully, even in traditional sets with a fullback in between the tackles with a guy like Deion Lewis, I think that makes that offense harder to defend. So, yeah, I think they want to run the ball. They'll keep everybody involved, but I think you might continue to see Deion Lewis be the top dog.
Last week, Brady did a good job of spreading it around a number of different receivers. Are they still sort of figuring out the pecking order here in the post-Edelman world?
Yeah, you know, Edelman was a guy that basically every year you were going to throw him 130 passes, and he would catch somewhere between 90 and 110 of those or whatever it was. When you change those targets the way they have to, because, you know, Danny Amendola sort of replicates the Edelman role, but A, his health is always an issue. I'm not sure you can throw it to him that often. And B, he's not quite the same receiver. So now you're sort of divvying up those 130 targets, and you don't have a player in that role that can run those quick slants and option routes and things that Edelman did. So you've had to go down the field more, and part of that is because you have weapons that go down the field with Brandon Cooks and Rob Gronkowski and even Chris Hogan to some degree. And then you've really seen James White evolve into the leading receiver on this team, and not in the same way that Edelman would, but, you know, those dump-off passes and quick little throws that are sort of like runs, but they're part of the passing game. And, yeah, you know, Brady talked about it. He's happy. He doesn't seem upset in any way at the evolution of the offense. He likes the way these guys work for him, and I think he is still getting more comfortable. And I think you've seen Cook is a better player down the field. He hasn't had a lot of success on the short throws, the quick slants and in cuts. I don't know that that's the strength of his game. I think he's better beating guys down the field in the intermediate and deep routes. So, it's an evolution without Edelman, and I think that makes sense when you lose essentially, I don't know, a third of where your targets normally usually go.
Andy Hart, Patriots Football Weekly, getting us ready for the L.A. Chargers. I've forgotten it about 11 times this week myself. Well, apparently most of the fans in L.A. have forgotten, too.
Yeah, they're a very forgettable team right now. I think everybody keeps calling them San Diego. They might be better off going back to San Diego in the long run and trying to get that fan base down there going again.
All right. Well, Andy, we appreciate you making time for us here so close to game time, and we'll check in with you again very soon. Enjoy the game.
Okay, and tell Brian Cranston I'm coming for him. Next year, I'm kicking his ass.
All right. The gauntlet has been thrown down. Walter White's in trouble. Thanks, Andy.
That's right.
That's Andy Hart of Patriots Football Weekly here on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. When we come back, Bruce Cameron has made a pretty good career in the last decade or so, writing some wonderful books with dogs as both central character and a narrator. His newest, A Dog's Way Home, is out right now. Bruce talks about it with us next on The Best of Downtown.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts. At 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person, and online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
Hey, hey. Now, don't you tell me you don't remember me, because I sure as heck fire remember you.
Downtown with Rich Kimball and the Briar Patch present An Evening with actor and author Stephen Tobolowsky, Wednesday night, November 15 at 7:30.
Within 1 minute, I was mistaken for being both a cab driver and a jet pilot. That is acting.
Stephen Tobolowsky at the Brewer Performing Arts Center, Pendleton Street in Brewer.
Bang!
Whether you know him as Ned Ryerson from Groundhog Day or from his roles on Silicon Valley, The Goldbergs, Memento, or Deadwood, you'll love the stories he shares from his new book, My Adventures with God.
Am I right or am I right? Or am I right?
Tickets are $30 and are on sale at The Briar Patch, Central Street in Bangor. And your ticket to the show also gets you a copy of Stephen's new book, My Adventures with God.
Bang!
Don't miss Stephen Tobolowsky, November 15 in Brewer.
Movie stories mixed with life stories.
Proceeds benefit Congregation Bethel of Bangor.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. My company is ClearPoint Financial. We're an independent retirement plan advisory firm located right here in Bangor, Maine. At ClearPoint Financial, we provide guidance-based, comprehensive retirement plan solutions to companies that are concerned about their employees' retirement income security. We focus on plan participants. We help them strive to achieve retirement income security. We provide ongoing engagement, education, investment advice, and service that exceeds expectation. For more details on our financial wellness programs, call me today at 899-2552. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail.
Speaking of dogs, Bella is the narrator of a wonderful new book by our next guest on the Best of Downtown, best-selling author W. Bruce Cameron. The book is A Dog's Way Home. We found out from Bruce as well, it's going to become a major motion picture. Our conversation about A Dog's Way Home with author W. Bruce Cameron on the Best of Downtown. Thanks again for embarrassing me in front of my family when I'm reading the book and my little guy's like, Daddy, why are you crying? Well, shut up. It's about a dog. It's killing me here.
So you had some allergy issues when you were reading that book.
I did yet again. And the book is wonderful. And Bella is such a sympathetic and wonderful narrator. What made you decide to have the dog be the narrator of the story?
Well, you know, it starts with a dog's purpose. The narrator of the book and movie, A Dog's Purpose, is a dog. And that turns out to be actually really hard to do. It's hard to describe the world from the viewpoint of a dog, because he's got a creature that can't see the color red or doesn't know what an hour is. And so there's just all kinds of things that you throw in there as a writer, and then you go back and read it, and you just cringe and say, well, wait a minute, we have to take that out. The dog can't say the cop car had red and blue flashing lights. It wouldn't see the red flashing lights. So when I was, you know, working on perfecting that, I wrote A Dog's Purpose and A Dog's Journey, the sequel. And then this book, A Dog's Way Home, is told, it's an entirely different thing. There's no magical premise. It is based on reality, which is that dogs are sometimes banned from cities because of their breed. And that's what happens to Bella. She's banned from Denver. She's sent away to a foster home while her owner tries to work things out. And she decides a horrible mistake has been made, and she jumps the fence and takes off and heads up into the mountains for a multi-year trek through some of the most unhospitable territory in the United States.
just to be back with her person.
Well, and what's wonderful as the owner of a dog who we're pretty sure has got a little bit of pit bull in her is that you do address the subject of what people refer to as bully breeds, and the fact that you can't identify a dog simply by their breed. The story goes much deeper than that.
Well, that's exactly right. Saying a pit bull is a bit like saying a hound dog. It's an entire classification of dogs. And so it really is based not on DNA tests, but just on what the dog looks like. So if your dog resembles a pit bull, whether it's got just a little bit of pit bull or a pure pit bull, doesn't matter. If it looks like a pit bull, the animal control officers can decide that it's a pit bull. Sometimes they decide the other way. They say, well, I know it looks exactly like a pit bull, but we decided this is actually a dachshund or something. They can do that too. That's what happens to Bella. Bella is classified as a pit bull. She probably looks more like a Rottweiler than a pit bull, but she is classified as a pit, ergo, she's banished, and if they pick her up again, they will euthanize her. So A Dog's Way Home is about this poor dog being sentenced to death for no crime other than just looking like a pit bull.
On her long odyssey to try and make her way back to Lucas, she encounters a lot of folks along the way, but it's a great lesson that the idea of the perfect dog is, I think, based more on the relationship between dog and companion. And in this case, I think I've seen you describe it, that Bella and Lucas, they're not perfect, but they're the just right match, and she's the just right dog for him.
Yeah, I think all of us who have had more than one dog in our lives have had relationships all over the place with dogs, and sometimes there is this inexplicable relationship where you and the dog have bonded on a level that you didn't suspect you had. In A Dog's Way Home, that's exactly what happens between Lucas and the dog, Bella. They bond at a level that is like instant and magnetic and hard to describe, and it isn't as if Bella doesn't love other people. In fact, Bella becomes sort of an unofficial, top-secret therapy dog for a group of veterans who are at the VA, because that's where Lucas works. And it is just part of Bella's life that she learns the comfort of a variety of people. But at the center of it is her love for Lucas, and that when she starts making her way home, all she's doing is thinking about, I've got to be home with my family, and especially my Lucas.
We're talking with Bruce Cameron. His new book is A Dog's Way Home, and you mentioned that the book does live very much in the real world. I have to imagine from this, you had to have done a fair amount of research on the treatment of veterans, because it's such a clear and thorough description of what they have to deal with.
Well, I was privileged enough to be given sort of a behind-the-scenes tour at one of the Veterans Administration hospitals, and I had an opportunity to talk to some veterans and some veterans' children about the variety of challenges that are often met by our servicemen and women who have given so much and sacrificed so much, and then they come back to a society that perhaps, in some or even most cases, isn't really prepared to help them through adjusting back to civilian life. But study after study have shown that having a dog can really assist with that transition. So it was a delight to be able to address all these issues through the eyes of a dog who is just doing what dogs do and serving people and trying to figure out what its purpose is in the world.
Well, and we see that also in the book when you deal with the issue of homelessness. And again, the humanity that we see and feel for homeless people who, you know, there's a tendency among even the best people sometimes to not want to make eye contact. But through the eyes of a dog, we look into their eyes and their soul and learn a lot more about their plight in life.
Yeah, there's a homeless man, and he is also a veteran, in Dog's Way Home. And I wanted to treat him differently than I've seen represented in stories and up on the screen before. So he's a very complex character. He definitely has some issues, but the town itself is heartbroken over the fate of this man. It's a very small town in Colorado, and they are heartbroken over his condition, which is deteriorating. And I think the way that the town responds and tries to respond and tries health is really indicative of the heart of us, we Americans, and how we really truly feel about our service people. Our hearts are always in the right place and aching, even if we don't know exactly what to do.
Now, I did notice, well, starting from the very beginning of the book, when they're together under an abandoned house here, the relationship that Bella has with cats in this book, very, very different than Bailey's perspective on cats in a dog's purpose.
Yeah, Bailey in a dog's purpose absolutely can barely tolerate cats and thinks of them as being entirely unnecessary. Bella, on the other hand, is raised with feral cats, believes probably for a while that she is a cat, you know. And I think that, of course, there's a lot of things that happen in a dog's way home that have to do with cats. And it's a delight for me to be able to surprise people with some of the plot developments that have to do with Bella's fondness for felines.
I see that you're traveling the country talking about the book, but also talking about screenwriting, and you did that. You were one of the screenwriters for the movie version of A Dog's Purpose. This book also, to me, is very cinematic. Is that the nature of the story you told, or is it because of your work in creating the film version of A Dog's Purpose?
Well, I think when I write, I always am picturing things in my head. I sort of feel like I'm writing down a movie that I'm watching in my head. And so my writing is rather easily converted to a screenplay, if the word easy can be ever be used to describe movie making. And I'm pleased to tell you that tomorrow morning I'm getting on an airplane and flying up to Vancouver, where we are shooting scenes for a Sony-produced film version of A Dog's Way Home.
Oh, that's fantastic news.
Yeah. I have not been allowed to talk about it, but I guess the news has started to leak out. There's no official announcement, but the director has been walking around saying, well, I'm directing this new book from W. Bruce Cameron, so I guess if he can talk about it, I guess I should be.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, we certainly look forward to that. Could you ever have imagined when you began work, because you've written a number of things before A Dog's Purpose, but as you started work on that, would you imagine that you would become, in many ways, the voice of dogs, but a voice that relates to so many, not just dog lovers, but animal lovers around the world?
Yeah, no. I had no idea. I had one idea, and that was for a dog that is reincarnated and remembers his lives and describes it from his point of view. I did not expect from that day on that every book I published would have a picture of a dog on the cover, but that's how it goes. And even my murder mystery, I have a paranormal murder mystery series, and there's a dog on the cover. Now, there's a dog in the book, because when I write, I'm writing about normal people, and to me, if you're normal, you have a dog. I mean, I get why James Bond doesn't have a chihuahua, but most people are normal, and I'm always sitting there in the movie and saying, okay, you're in a normal American family. There are other normal American families in this movie. Where are their dogs? Why are there no dogs? And so when I write a story about a repo man in northern Michigan, and who solves murders, and he's got a dog, and so they put the dog on the cover. Oh, well, I mean, I guess that's just the world I live in now.
So dogs are so attuned to us and our behavior. They're such observers of the human condition here. Have you noticed, since you started writing these books, do the dogs treat you any differently?
No, they don't.
That's our guy. Be good to him.
So, I asked one woman, I was in the movie theater, and she brought her dog with her, and the dog seemed to be watching The Dog's Purpose and was really excited about it. And, like, I went down to her, and I said, I'm amazed. It seemed like your dog followed the whole picture. And she says, and I said, your dog really liked the movie. And she said, I know, I'm amazed, too, because he didn't care for the book.
There you go. Perfect right there. W. Bruce Cameron, the new book, A Dog's Way Home. Read it. Grab it. You're going to love it. It's a terrific read, as always. And now the news that this will be a film. We look forward to that as well. Bruce, great talking with you again. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Look forward to the next time.
That's Bruce Cameron talking with us about his new book, A Dog's Way Home. When we return, some music conversation. Colin Fleming joins us to talk about The Who and Nick Drake next on Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Whatever you're looking for, G&M Family Market has got what you need. They're on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. They have fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, a Dunkin' Donuts right there, and an Amato's as well. And if there's something you can't find, just ask, and they'll make every effort to get it for you next time. It's G&M Family Market, Route 1A, Route 46 in Holden. They're open every day from 6 in the morning until 9 p.m.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
Go Blue!
Sir, you're here for the cheerleading tryouts?
Yeah, for the class of 82. Gotta show my school spirit.
I know a better way. The UMaine Alumni Signature Rewards Visa Card from University Credit Union. Low rates, no annual fees, and it earns reward points for travel, merchandise, or cash back.
Woo, sounds easier than a backflip.
Apply online today at UMaineAlumniCard.com.
Federally insured by NCUA. Terms and conditions apply, subject to credit approval.
Polaris is now at Friend and Friend in Orono. Polaris side-by-sides, Polaris Rangers, Polaris Razors, Polaris ATVs, Polaris snowmobiles. The Polaris factory authorized clearance is going on now, with massive rebates up to $2,500 on non-currents, making now the time to buy. On-the-spot financing. Get your off-road vehicle today at Friend and Friend Polaris in Orono. Easy on, easy off. Exit 193 on I-95, just 5 minutes from Hogan Road. Polaris at Friend and Friend in Orono, now.
It's my favorite time of the year.
Why is that?
Because it is when the area's best kennel and best pet store, Green Acres Kennel Shop, joins forces with the region's best pet photographer, Deborah Bell of Bell's Furry Friends Photography, for their annual holiday pet portraits.
Wow, I forgot all about that. Thanks for the reminder.
This year, Deb will be taking holiday pet portraits at Green Acres from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Sunday, November 5th.
Your pets will love Deb's relaxed, pet-friendly approach, and you will love how the images she captures will look on your wall or a holiday card.
Deb only charges $65, and that includes a $10 donation to the Furry Friends Food Bank.
Each 20-minute session gives you a 5x7 color print and access to an online gallery to view other photos of your pet that you can choose to purchase.
Just remember, there are a limited number of spaces, and they fill fast. Call 945-6841 to reserve your spot today.
Green Acres Kennel Shop, your pet's home away from home. Union Street, Bangor.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, a home away from home.
Next up on The Best of Downtown, we talk music with our friend, author, and critic Colin Fleming, talking about a couple of British artists, Nick Drake, but first of all, The Who. And hard to believe, Colin, that this song by The Who, I Can See for Miles, was the only top 10 hit they ever had on the American Billboard charts.
They were not chart winners, as it were. They also never had a number one.
unless you count something that I think was like in Germany. But no, they did not exactly dominate the charts, although they were a regular presence on them.
Although you make a case that they are arguably the greatest singles band of all time.
I think that they are the British band that came closest to pushing the envelope right off the cliff in terms of singles. When you think about what they were doing, it was so bravura in some ways, so finesse in other ways. You had this avant-garde element, a jazz element. If you think about the improvisational aspect of something like My Generation at the end, when it's just this devil-may-care sort of free-for-all, seemingly, but there's real control and structure. Pete Townsend is marshaling feedback in a way no one ever had before. And then you have the person I think is the most gifted instrumentalist in all of rock and roll. That includes like Jimi Hendrix on the guitar, and that would be Keith Moon on drums, who dominated those early singles in a way that he was really the lead instrument. He was the conductor, he was the rhythmic presence, he was sort of the character of the band, and everything else was built up from around his drum parts.
And also a somewhat unusual relationship in rock, with Townsend writing most of the songs, but Roger Daltrey giving them voice.
Yes, and Townsend, if you listen to his demos, he had so much of it figured out, even the parts that John Entwistle would play on bass, and some of what Keith Moon would do. But Daltrey was very much like a rhythm and blues shouter early on, and then I think he kind of grew into the personas that Townsend wrote for him. It was the symbiosis that I can't really think of another example like that in rock. And eventually, Daltrey became, even though he had a limited vocal range, one of the great interpreters of what turned out to be one of the greatest compositional outputs in all of rock and roll. If you listen to something like Tommy, he really embodies that character by the time we get to the rock opera. But this new package that just came out is pretty much their singles, and there's some of Tommy on that, of course, because like Overture was released as a single, and everybody knows Pinball Wizard. I don't think there's a song you can recognize more instantaneously than Pinball Wizard. Like, it's just that, what, like a chord, and you're like, aha, got it. And they just were doing so many things. It's very uncommon to mix populism with the avant-garde, something that like really like blue-collar steel workers in like England could relate to. It's also awfully heady, too, for the intellectuals.
Well, and you look at some of the singles they released through the years, from My Generation, Kids Are All Right. You mentioned Pinball Wizard, Magic Bus, Won't Get Fooled Again, Behind Blue Eyes, Squeezebox, Who Are You, on and on it goes. I was shocked when I went through the Billboard records to see that Baba O'Reilly, which is certainly one of their most recognizable songs of all time, never even charted in America.
They were an album band, really, more so than a singles band by that point. And it's strange because they didn't release like a ton of albums. You think about like kind of the pace that people were on at the time. You would do two albums a year, maybe. You'd do some singles. Not the Who. I mean, you were getting like nine studio albums for the most part. And by 1971, in the time of Baba O'Reilly, Won't Get Fooled Again, those tracks were longer. They weren't really like singles as we think of singles. But you mentioned something like The Kids Are All Right. Listen to the drum part on that. It's like a Tony Williams, who was the drummer in Miles Davis' second great quintet, drum concerto. Moon just, he is driving the entire song, and Townsend would write these little interstitches almost within, like, between the beats. And Moon would fill in those spaces himself on these crazy fills around his kit. You have to be so dynamically athletic in a way, and also to have, like, a built-in metronome in your head so that you can come out of those fills and go back to keeping the beat, which is just an outlandish kind of virtuosity. It's like Paganini behind a drum kit. And that is the trademark, one of the trademarks of those early singles. Also, Pete Townsend's guitar. There's not a lot of guitar solos, and yet he's very Bachian in the way he deploys the instrument. He'll have like a chord here that sets up another chord, almost like a mini Tristan chord out of Wagner. 2.5 minutes later, and he's just keeping that straight throughout the composition, those kind of like broken down bitty guitar bits that add up to these continuous musical ideas that rejoin themselves later, and you're like, ah, that's what he was doing. Makes perfect sense.
Well, and for a band that came to prominence first in the 1960s, a late British invasion band. There weren't many that had a second act in the 70s and into the early 80s like The Who did that led to chart success other than maybe The Stones.
Right, and The Who very nearly didn't get there because they're in 1968. They've had their run of those early singles. They've had The Who sellout album, a concept album, where they pretend to be a British pirate radio station, meaning like you're floating in a boat off of England, and because then you could get around like certain like contractual legalities, and they're doing fake commercials. It was very like arty, but then like they weren't going anywhere. They weren't making money. They were destroying their instruments on the stage, which was costing them money. They had like Magic Bus in 1968, which is like, oh, okay, kind of works, kind of didn't. And they basically had one last chance to try to either keep going or this is going to be it. And Townsend came up with Tommy, and that is what birthed the second act. If you listen to something like the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, that concert film orchestrated by the Stones, it's the Stones kind of like big cinematic event. The Who had been in the studio recording Tommy, and they show up and they do one song, a quick one while he's away, and they just blow the Stones out of the ocean with it. And like you could tell, this is maybe the best single live performance ever, that like you just cannot hang on the stage with these guys. They were that dynamic in concert, and they translated that energy into the studio too.
And somehow they were able to survive the two huge blows that took place in the late 70s. First and foremost, the death of Keith Moon, but then the tragedy of the concert in Cincinnati.
I'd say that they did and they didn't. They carried on as The Who after that, certainly. And Moon, by the time of like 1978, his last gig was in Toronto in 1976, unless you count the Shepherd Inn film recording that they did in 78. But his playing had really spiraled downward. He was out of shape, overweight, all of that. And they remained The Who in name only, pretty much. They transitioned into a very different kind of band. If you listen to the shows they did from 1979 with Kenny Jones, like they're still good, but they're not the world beaters that they had been. And then eventually they started saying, well, we're done, we're not coming back. And then they came back. They came back again and again and again and again. So now you have The Two instead of The Who. But I feel like when you're going to something like that now, it's almost like you're going so you can say you saw these people, and it's like a night of maybe drunken karaoke for you where you shout out like lyrics from Won't Get Fooled Again and all of that. But to me, the band kind of like ended in 75 or so with The Who by numbers.
One of the great clips you can find out there on YouTube, for my money, is their remarkable appearance on the Smothers Brothers show apparently in rehearsal, the explosion that they had set up with Keith Moon's drum kit wasn't quite big enough, so he added a little to it, and then, of course, it went all to hell in the middle of the Smothers Brothers taping.
Keith Moon was a weird guy, dangerous guy. His wife said at one point, like, some days Keith would get up and he decided to be Hitler. And he was going to dress up as Hitler. Like, you did not know what you were getting personality-wise, pyrotechnically-wise, I guess, in terms of the Smothers Brothers. But it's strange, because if you listen to Tommy, something like that, and you listen to the overture, and it starts off with John Entwistle, and the French horn and everything, then there's like this moment where the drums kick in and they almost kind of like double back on themselves really quickly before they get off into this galloping march. And it really shows you like this crazy guy who was so unstable in life was so stable musically, because those drums are basically going to be your friend, your compatriot, escorting you through this world that Tommy goes into. It's almost like Virgil, like palling around with like Dante, being like, oh, it'll be fine, just come along with me. And you get the sense that, like, in that way, Moon was a really good, there's something extra musical about that. Like, he's a really good guy, but would you want to go out with him that night and, like, rest assured that you be safe and make it home? Like, no, probably not. Probably want to do something else with some different friends.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, let's go to a different type of music, but a very talented individual who you could safely say more popular now than while he was alive. Let's listen to a little bit of Nick Drake.
so it's safe. Finger moon is on its way. None of you stand so tall. Finger moon, then I get you.
Nick Drake from his last album, the title cut of Pink Moon, and a guy who was certainly not appreciated in his time, but has found a whole second musical life, really, over the last 15 or 20 years.
It's like when you mention The Who and their maybe lack of chart success. I think one of the reasons is they're so quintessentially English. And Nick Drake is a far cry from the glorious racket kicked up by The Who, but he's also very quintessentially English. Now, that song there from his final album, which was like a Volkswagen commercial, too. That's why a lot of people started to know Nick Drake.
Right.
Again, the album is only like 25 minutes long. He had a very mysterious death, overdose, suicide, young man. But to me, when I hear things that he did, it's almost like John Clare, like the English poet. He was kind of a contemporary, near contemporary, basically, of someone like Keats. And he was this peasant. He was so poor. He rode on the back of bark. But he'd go out into the woods and become one with birds' nests and nature. And I feel like when we hear Nick Drake, you hear kind of that autumnal countryside of England, of greensward and copses of trees and that kind of thing. It's very evocative, especially his first two albums, Five Leaves Left and Brighter Later. But by the time we get to Pink Moon, we're moving into more metaphysical territory, more existential angst. And it's funny because John Clare, the poet who would write about nature all the time, at the end of his life, he started writing the same way that we find that Nick Drake did as well. But yes, it's 25 minutes long, his last album. But that 25 minutes might as well be 2,500 hours for all of the emotion that is packed into it. He showed up at his record label, and he has this tape, and basically he just says, this is all that's left. Puts the tape down with the receptionist, leaves, and that was kind of going to be it.
And apparently he was never really happy with the production on his albums, felt that they were overproduced. He always wanted a simpler, more basic sound.
Yes. He also didn't help his own cause by not performing live. He was very reticent about doing that. We only have one radio session that exists from John Peel. But yeah, that was, he felt they were too stringy, too syrupy, that kind of thing.
Why is it that he's become so much more popular now? You know, you mentioned the commercials. They've been used in a lot of movies and television shows. Was he, I guess, ahead of his time or out of his time?
I think he's someone who definitely stands outside of time. There can be kind of little pockets, these little movements that pick up on him, like a little emo movement type of thing. And I wonder about kind of the legitimacy of, I feel like a lot of people like to name check Nick Drake, and it makes me wonder how often people listen to Nick Drake. But the people who do listen to him, your hardcore Nick Drake people, they will tell you that there is nothing like him. It's a completely singular sound. There's no overlap with anybody else, and they will be the diehards who listen to his home recordings. And there's one of them where it's him at his parents' place, and he is just kind of talking into the tape recorder, and it's kind of charming in a way. It's also really naive, and yet you hear this genius behind it. And he says basically, well, I've had some wine tonight, and I'm just thinking about life and everything. And it's like, you know, probably how everyone else would be when they're a certain age, and yet he's doing these songs, and it's like, okay, well, that's a bit beyond what other people can do.
Colin, of his three albums, for somebody who's not familiar with Nick Drake, where would you recommend starting?
I'd probably start with Brighter Later. It is very tuneful. The man could write a melody. He could be like Schubert with a melody, and that's probably a good start. I would say, I mean, for me personally, Pink Moon is my favorite, but once you get up to speed, what you're going to want to do, you're not going to want to schedule like an evening out at the club after this.
No,
like, you're not going anywhere else. listen to the recordings he made that are not on the three albums from February 1974. Now, if you're someone who likes the blues and you think Robert Johnson's music, kind of like Deal with the Devil, Crossroads, so emotionally galvanic, Nick Drake with Black Eyed Dog, he goes several paces beyond that. It is the single most harrowing work I've heard from the 20th century. And I don't even know how you kind of like get up and go to work after it. So make it be like the last thing you do at night, maybe have some cocoa to comfort you. It's someone really looking into a kind of abyss and creating great art from that viewpoint.
Nick Drake talking about it with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Colin, what are we talking about next week?
We are doing some Halloween fun.
Oh, yes.
With the writer William Sloan, who isn't very well known, but he had two novels. That was it. One's from 1937. One is from 1939. The latter is actually set in Maine. And I would say that the first one, To Walk the Night, 1937 one, is the best horror novel I know from the 20th century. It's one of the best novels I know, period. It has not dated at all. It starts off with two buddies going to a football game at their alma mater, so it's perfect for this time of the year, and it is unlike anything else you will ever read.
That's Colin Fleming talking music with us here as we wrap up the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. Thank you so much for making us a part of your Sunday and your weekend. Casey Kasem, American Top 40, the 80s, coming up next. Great week of things here on the program. Thursday, Bryan Cranston returns to the show just about a year after the last time he was on with us. Bryan's got a new film, Last Flag Flying, with Steve Carell, Lawrence Fishburne, directed by Richard Linklater. We'll talk with him about that, as well as his upcoming appearance on the London stage, the National Theatre, producing what should be fabulous, Paddy Chayefsky's Network. Bryan will play the mad prophet of the airwaves, Howard Beale, in that production. So Bryan Cranston, Thursday on the show. Bill Green joins us on Wednesday. Tuesday, a little Halloween treat for you as we bring back the Downtown Radio Players production of Zero Hour by Ray Bradbury. Old-style radio drama, sound effects, music, the whole deal. We had a blast putting it together last year. Ryan Waning produced the whole thing for us, and we're making it a holiday tradition as we bring back Zero Hour. A little suspense for you, and that'll be 5:30, right before you go out trick-or-treating, Tuesday on the show. And then Monday, a great lineup to get the week started. Charlotte Wilder of SB Nation, one of our favorite guests. Michael Hurley, CBS Boston, and 98.5 The Sports Hub, talking Patriots with us. Joe Harris-Simiak, University of Maine Black Bear football coach. Alan Adams of the Maine Edge. Mike Violet, a healthy active living minute from St. Joe's Healthcare, and more. All tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Thanks for being with us. Carrie, good luck with all you have to do today. Buttoning down the house.
Yes, huh? Doing that fall cleanup and ready for winter. Got to make room in the garage for my wife's car.
Do I rake the leaves before we leave the house? New owners coming in soon.
No.
Oh, you didn't even hesitate.
No.
I like that confidence. Thank you. I'll leave a note.
And if they ask, you say, we leave the leaves for winter cover to protect the grass.
Exactly. I say that all the time. You know, I can tell you what will happen. I'll leave them. My neighbors will be embarrassed by what I've done to the neighborhood. They'll rake them. They'll leaf blow them. They'll mulch, whatever. They'll be gone. Either way, I won't have to do it. It's a win for everyone. Hey, thanks for being with us. Enjoy your Sunday. We'll catch you tomorrow afternoon at 4 right here on Downtown.